string it together with some older work on defects, and then work on our work our way towards a classification algorithm. So to set the stage, as you might know, of course you know, if you are interested in condensed matter, you're really interested in order of systems, right? So it has been long known that, of course, there's some landscape in this in how you can view this order. So on the one hand, it has been well established for a long time that you can associate the order by symmetry breaking. So can everybody see my cursor, by the way?
Yeah, we can.
So so on the left hand, you see a lattice, and this lattice breaks, for example, the continuous space-time Euclidean space. And therefore, you can characterize this order of the lattice by symmetry breaking, right? So this has been a well established phenomenon. On the other hand, with the especially not exclusively, but especially with the experimental finding of the quantum Hall effects, also topology has been emerging as a very organizing principle to characterize ordering in condensed matter. Right, so in topology, everybody knows that you can have intrinsic topology, so then you have to think fractional quantum Hall effect, in which one has a ground state degeneracy, fractionalized excitation. But somewhat more recently, it became known that one can actually combine the concepts of symmetry and topology to create so-called SPT states. So these are states that have a topology by virtue of the symmetry, and these can actually again, mimic all the cool features of topology, like having edge states and if actually also even fractionalized excitations if you have on defects and on edges. And as I said, this SPT states can come about in interacting and in free systems. And in particular, I want to focus today on the simplest case, just free systems of SPT states. So, in essence, band theory, and in this band theory, I want to incorporate symmetries and think about which of kind of topological states one can have. So to make this a bit more explicit, with the introduction with the finding of the topological insulator, which I'll come to in a moment, it was soon realized that this free SPT state, or in other words, how to classify topological band structures under symmetries. Can be organized in a table, and this was realized by Kitaev predominantly, but also by Ryu, Kurosaki, and Schneider. And this you can view as somewhat of a modern periodic table. So what this table tells me is that if I specify my time reversal symmetry or my particle hole symmetry or their product chiral symmetry, I get 10 symmetry classes, and for each of these symmetry classes, I can specify in each dimension how many different topological band structures I can have, right? How many of these band structures are topological distinct, given I have this symmetry in the system. So, in particular, everybody knows that if you have no symmetries at all, then you have a Z classification in 2D. So this is the well-known quantum Hall effect, right? So one has an insulating droplet. So this is again an insulator, but it's topologically distinct, which is signaled by an invariant, and also edge states going in a clockwise fashion around the perimeter of the sample you're looking at, right? So this is the ordinary quantum Hall effect that everybody knows for a long time. And as I said, this whole field was kind of triggered by the finding that one also can have Z2 order. So in the quantum Hall effect, I have edge states that go clockwise or anticlockwise, and I have some well-defined topological number in the bulk, which is called the Turing number, which is actually in accordance with this transverse conductivity, with roughly speaking how many edge states I have on the boundary. So then it was figured out that one also can have a new kind of phase, which is protected by time reversal symmetry. So look, I'm now in class A2, in which I have time reversal symmetry. It squares to minus one, so I'm looking at fermions. And in this case, I have a Z2 order. So thinking about this quantum Hall effect, I can actually view it in 2D as two copies of a quantum Hall effect, in which one spin goes one way and the other spin goes the other way. So and in this case, one doesn't have a Z classification, so it cannot count how many states go clockwise or anticlockwise. But in this case, either you have like an odd or an even pair And this is topological. So these two possibilities of having an even or an odd number of edge states gives you actually also two different topological states, which can also be really quantified by a topological number in the box. So by this Z2 number. To make it a bit more intuitive, one can think like, okay, let's go to the boundary. Because I'm assuming to have a system with time reversal symmetry, so in other words, and I have spinful fermions, this means that on specific momenta on the edge, I have points that are time reversal invariant, and at these points I should have Cramer's pairs. So every band should come in a pair, as you can see here and here. And if I go to the edge, you see that if I have this Cramer's pair here and this Cramer's pair here, that I have two ways of connecting them, right? So I can connect them pairwise, or I can connect them in this fashion. And you see when I now introduce a Fermi level, that here I cannot get rid of the crossings, whereas here I can actually do that adiabatically. So that's like an intuitive picture of how one could view these two different states. But to be more specific, I want to talk about this table in general. So how does this table come about? It has been figured out by Kitaev, in particular, that this maps to a mathematical object called K-theory. So K-theory gives me some. Let's view it for the moment as a mathematical machinery. And which outputs a number. So in particular, it outputs these numbers here. So which allows me to a priori already establish on symmetry grounds how many different topological phases one can have. So in a very crude essence, K theory is basically doing algebra with vector bundles, and in particular, it has a stable element which allows me to add trivial bands to a system without affecting the classification. And so K-theory has some stable equivalents. Now the whole point of this talk would to address two main questions about this table. So first of all, the description I just gave about K-theory was rather vague. And what I want to show you is that this K-theory can actually be calculated in a very easy manner for class A. So when I assume no symmetries, I can calculate this K-theory in a very easy way. But I don't want to calculate K-theory just for this table, because the second question I want to address is this table all? Is there more beyond this table? Because here I'm specifying the unitary and anti-unitary symmetries, like time reversal symmety, particle hole symmetry, and the product chiral symmetry. But the first question one might ask, is there more? And of course the question will be, yes, there is more beyond this tenfold way. In particular, one can think about crystal symmetries, as I already alluded to in the title of the talk. And what I want to show you is that when I include this crystal symmetries, then I can calculate this K-theory extremely easily. And I will present an algorithm for that. So that will be the second part of the talk, whereas the first part of the talk will actually going up to this, giving you some intuitive picture about this classification, how it came about. And to do so, remember that I want to talk about this K-theory in class A, but maybe a bit unconventional. To get there, I want to first present some ideas about classifying stuff in class A2. So to summarize, what I will be talking about is like class A2, some ideas about the defect physics and classification procedures in this kind of systems, and how they can actually be used to understand this K-theory from really matching the mathematical angle when I include crystal symmetries in class A. So that will be the purpose of this talk. Okay, so as I said, the first question one might ask is this tenfold way really everything? Is there life beyond the tenfold way? And the question here, the answer to this question is obviously yes. First, remember that when I'm in class A, for example, this is really like quantum Hall physics, right? So this means that I've assumed that I have a theta vacuum, so a kind of a continuum theory. Indeed, this tenfold way can be constructed with this Furusaki and Ludwig paper, which actually uses continuum theory. So, yeah, but in the end, when you're really thinking about the band structure, you have to break the translations and rotations of space time of time sorry in space in the first place, because if you don't break the continuous translations, you don't have a band structure to begin with. So this is a little bit different from quantum Hall effects. So crystal symmetries are really in the game. In other words, if I'm thinking about symmetry protected topological states, I mean, there is already the word symmetry in there, right? So if I add, I always have a natural associated symmetry from the underlying lattice, which is always there. So one can think about what are the implications for that? Are there implications? And the answer, as I said, will be yes. So to set the stage, I want just to start with a very easy example, a very, very nice example, and that's due to Liang Fu. And it works as follows. So let's just assume for the moment, I will go to class A2 in a moment, but just let us assume that we just have spinless fermions. Spinless fermions that, and assume on top of that that I have time reversal symmetry. So because these are spinless fermions, time reversal symmetry is nothing else but complex conjugation, right? So this argument I just gave for this, even an odd, really dependent on the fact that I had spin-full fermions, class A2, but now I'm just assuming that I have spinless fermions. So as I said, time reversal symmetry for spinless fermions is nothing but complex conjugation. And then I have my Hamiltonian will follow this symmetry and will respect this symmetry. But now let's assume that we have more. So in particular, I want to assume that instead of only having time reversal symmetry, I also have T4 rotations. So in C4 rotations, I can in particular envision that I just have a tetragonal lattice, right? So that I have this axis. And I have C4 rotations, okay? Now, if I have C4 rotations, then again, this is a symmetry of my Hamiltonian by assumption, and my C4 rotations do rotate by 90 degrees, right? So my Hamiltonian will, on top of having time reversal symmetry, also respect this symmetry incorporated by the operator U. Now, the whole point here is now that if I have this operator U, then I have points in the Brillouin, so I can, if I have a tetragonal lattice in real space and I go to Fourier space and I take a slice, then this is nothing but the square, right? And I can think about the high symmetry momenta like 0, 0, pi, 0, 0 pi, and pi, pi. Now, because this C4 rotations commute at this point, at this 0 and this pi, pi point, you see that the Hamiltonian gets mapped to itself. That means that any band that I have will have eigenvalues on the well-defined eigenvalues under this U at this 0, 0 and this pi pi point. And because these are nothing but fourfold rotation, so the eigenvalues are nothing but 1 e to the power I pi over 2, which gives me 1 minus 1 I and minus I. But remember that I also assume that I have time reversal symmetry, which is nothing but complex conjugation. And what that means is that it enforces the imaginary representations to form one real representation, to form a real representational. In other words, I get something very analogous to Kramer's pairs on these points, and then I know that I can connect them in two fashions. A bit more mathematically, I can actually find out that although I have spinless fermions, so I didn't have any C2 classification to begin with, I can now define a new operator, which is actually the product of my C4 rotation and time reversal symmetry, and that actually squares to minus 1, whereas time reversal symmetry itself squares to 1. And this gives me exactly the same idea that I can have the C2 classification by, as I said, very roughly speaking, one has something which looks very much like Ramus pairs between these points, and I can connect them in two different ways. And indeed, if I calculate this UT squared, it's in minus 1, so this is really acting like this effective time reversal symmetry operator. And to be a bit more specific, when I actually think about how I connect between this gamma and M point and between this Z and A point, for example, in this picture, and this would be something like weak indices, which I will be coming back to later. But the real point I want to make here is that I started from some spinless fermions, and you see now that I add C4 rotations, and outcomes actually that I can now have Z2. Two phase, very much like time reversal symmetry. So that's the only take-home message from this slide that I want to present. That if I add crystalline symmetries to the system, somehow, not somehow, but it's clear that I go beyond the tenfold way, right? So I can further enrich it. So to be a bit more specific, as I said, one can also think about so-called weak invariance. And what this has been figured out for a long time, that one has this weak invariance. But this weak invariance are actually also really a product of thinking about the tenfold way, but assuming something else. And the thing that you assume, what you in addition assume, is really translational symmetry. So when I think about a topological insulator in 3D, I can think about whether it has non-trivial behavior in planes, which is a meaningful thing to ask, because I know that there's a topological insulator in 3D characterized by a T2 invariant, but also in 2D. So it makes sense to think about slices, right? So as a maximal example, one can think about stacking 2D topological insulators in the third direction. So that means, obviously, that if I stack them, that my total Z2 invariant, so what's so-called the strong invariant, is actually zero. So if you want to think about this more intuitively, I just explained that if you go to the boundary, you can connect them even or odd. And here you always enclose like an even number of Fermi points. But when I really think about the 2D slices, so when I go in the Z direction, I actually have a stacking of 2D TIs, which is non-trivial within the plane. And this is really assuming that I have some system which has translational symmetry in the Z direction. Okay, so this weak invariance also really come from the tenfold way plus something else, and the something else here is exactly translational symmetry. More generically, you can not only have this stacking in the Z direction, but you can think of slicing up the cube generically. And so I can specify whether I really have an even or odd enclosing of Fermi points, which is the Z2 invariant, but also in which kind of planes I have this non-trivial behavior, right? So like here in the Z direction, and these are this three extra indices. So these are these weak invariants, which really come from tenfold way plus translational symmetry, which I have assumed, right? So I can think about, it's a meaningful statement to think about whether I have topological non-trivial behavior in either plane, because I know that the Z2 insulator exists in 3D, but also in 2D. Okay, that's very roughly the idea. Okay, so this is a bit more technical, but just bear with me for the moment. This Z2 index, so I've been talking about this Z2 index in class A2 systems, can actually be calculated in the following way due to Fu and Kane. So what I can think about, my field bands, so these are my UM and my UN, and I can sandwich them between the time reversal symmetry operator, this theta. Now, because this theta is an anti-symmetric operator, I have special points in the Brillouin zone, which I will call time reversal invariant points, where this object is anti-symmetric, obviously, because time reversal symmetry commutes there with the Hamiltonian, and it's an anti-unitary operator. So now I can actually rewrite the Z2 index in this manner, in the following way, that this minus 1 to the power nu, where nu is the Z2 index, is the product of this of delta y. So again, this is anti-symmetric, so I can think about this Pfaffian over determinant, which is actually this Pfaffian, just to recall, is nothing but the square root of determinant. So I'm really taking branch cuts here. And in a topological insulator, so when the Z2 index is non-trivial, I have to have an odd number of this opposite signs. So if I have everywhere plus 1, then this new is zero. So if I can find a branch in which everyone has the same sign, obviously new has to be zero, right? Because this is like the trivial case. But in the non-trivial case, I will have an odd number of this band inversions. So quote unquote. Roughly speaking, I'm not able to find like a single branch code for the whole system. So I have to have an odd number of this minus signs in the structure, right? So I just take the product over this 8 points or 4 points for a 2D system. And then if I have an odd number of this minus signs, I have a non-trivial C2 index, okay? So the reason why I'm saying this is that in particular, you can just now view, again, go back to this example I was just giving about this weak indices. So if I have weak indices, then in the maximal case, I have a trivial Z2 index, but you see that in the Z direction, I have actually non-trivial 2D planes. So these planes are non-trivial, right? So in terms of this formula, one has to think in this way. You see that if I consider this plane, I actually have an odd number of minus signs or an odd number of plus signs. But when I take the product of all eight of them, it's trivial. That's why I have a Z2 index that's actually trivial. But when I consider it in the plane, you see explicitly that this is a really a gauge invariant statement. And that's basically due to the fact how translations and time reversed symmetry operator works, because this product is a gauge invariant quantity, a bit more formally. But in other words, but intuitively we already knew this, because we knew that there is a topological insulator in 2D and in 3D. And with topological insulator, I mean the Z2 topological insulator in class A2. Okay. So as a very first step, the theme I want to address is that we have this tenfold way and we are adding extra symmetry. So in particular, I've now been talking about translational symmetries, but of course, if you have an underlying lattice, you have many more symmetries. So you actually have a whole space group. And as a very first step, we came up with the following kind of intuitive way of how one can incorporate this space group symmetries on the very first level. So if you think about this time reversed invariant points I defined here, so basically points at which the time reversed symmetry operator commutes with the Hamiltonian, you see that I have been assuming this 8 points. But in a generic system, if I have a more complicated underlying crystal structure, I of course have many. I don't have a Brillouin zone that's say a cube, but I have a Brillouin zone that has a more complicated manifold like this, or it's not a manifold, but a more complicated object like this. And then second of all, it's very important to notice that the points at which are you can call time reversal invariant points are actually set by the space group. So as an example, think about in 2D about a triangle lattice, which has a hexagonal Brillouin zone, then the normal time reversal invariant points are this guys, this four. But now, because h of minus k there, that's the condition to commute with time reversal symmetry. But if I have C6 symmetry, if I have six-fold symmetry in the Brillouin zone or in the underlying system in real space, equivalently, then this k plus and k minus also become time reversal invariant points, right? Because obviously C6 relates k plus to k minus. So I have this condition also satisfied. And it really comes from the fact that I don't have only time reversal symmetry, but have time reversal symmetry plus extra, and in this case, the C6 symmetry, okay? So the first point one can notice in calculating the C2 invariant is that actually the time reversal invariant momenta are set by the very space group on the very underlying space group. Secondly, an obvious statement is that if I have this delta y, so these are this plus or minus signs, very roughly speaking, that I'm calculating at this special point, that if these special points are related by some symmetry, then this delta y's obviously also have to be the same. So for example, if I have a cube, if I have a cube, then I have the normal 8 time reversal invariant points, but then there is of course always this threefold rotation that links this point. So this delta y at these three points have to be the same. Similarly for this one. So these are two ingredients that are obviously included. And then if one includes that, we came up with the following way and claimed that the distribution of the signs. So not the specific sign on each side, but the distribution of signs is giving you extra indications about. So it gives you an extra classification beyond this tenfold way. So an extra scheme. So in other words, what I'm claiming is that if I have this if I have this distribution of signs, that the one with the odd one out, so the with the minus one at the gamma, is something different than when this odd sign is placed at R. Okay, so you see, remember that I'm only looking at the distribution of signs, so I can everything can be multiplied by a minus sign. So this will be the same as plus minus minus minus. But I'm claiming that whether this odd one out is located at this point or at this point actually already gives you some indication about that this an extra layer of classification or scheme beyond the tenfold way. So to make this a bit more specific, we can do an example. And in my very favorite example is the square lattice, because it's the easiest. So if I have a square lattice, then my time reversing invariant momenta, so this point one, are the usual four. So this is 0, 0, pi, 0, pi, pi, and 0, pi. Now, if I think about the symmetry, then obviously x and y are related by the C4 symmetry, so they have the same sign. So you see there are three different ways of distributing this, three different distributions of the sign. So I can have this odd one out at gamma, I can have this odd one out at this endpoint, or I can have this odd one out at x and y. Note that here I actually have two minus signs, so the product of these guys will actually be even, and therefore mu will be zero. But roughly speaking, I cannot annihilate these two signs by bringing them together, because I'm also assuming the C4 symmetry. Remember that this whole extra scheme comes from the additional layer of symmetries. So this then we what I claim is that these three guys are actually different. And so this one, remember, is not protected by time reversal symmetry, but solely by this underlying crystalline symmetry. So then one can say, oh, you can claim whatever you want. This is of course very fine, but if these are really different, one should also be able to probe the difference. So that's the second part I want to get to. So can we probe this? And the answer to this question is actually yes. And it turns out that this extra layer of classification, which comes from including the extra symmetries of the underlying space group, can actually be probed by the defects of the lattice. And by defect in particular, I want to talk about dislocation. So this is a dislocation in corn, just to show you that these guys actually really exist. So here I have a dislocation in corn, and a dislocation is really nothing else but a defect here, which arises by an extra row of atoms. So you see that I have here this extra row of atoms. So this is really a defect corresponding to translations. And on the other hand, it's also topological, because you see for every loop that I draw around this defect, I always have to skip this extra row of atoms. Okay? It doesn't matter, as long as I encircle the defect, I always have to jump this extra row. So this is a defect that corresponds to translations, because I have to skip an extra row, and it's topological. That's why the prime candidate to actually probe this extra layer of classification I was just talking about. And indeed, one can do this. And to make this a bit more explicit, I just want to make a very short detour, and that's by remembering everybody that if I'm thinking about some topological insulator, so in class A2, a C2 topological insulator, everybody always goes to the edge state. I just also gave you the argument that when you go to the edge, you can connect them even or pairwise. But actually, the real real way of how to characterize this Z2 topological insulator is one can go to the bulk. And in particular, it turns out that one can really probe these TIs by phi fluxes. So I don't have all the time to go into details, but the point is this, that when I have a Z2 topological insulator, when I introduce a phi flux, remember that phi flux is the only value of flux that actually is time reversing invariant. If I probe this system by a phi flux, so really one really has to think about some solenoids here, so some phi flux here, then if I have a topological insulator, then actually I get a degenerate pair of modes in the gap. Whereas for a trivial insulator, I don't. So, and this is really gauging the underlying Z2 topological phase of the symmetry protected topological state. But just the take home message I want to give here is that if I probe the system with a phi flux, I get this degenerate pair of modes, or even or more generally an odd number of them in the bandgap. And these modes are interesting in themselves because because they are degenerate, I can actually populate them with 0, 1, or with 2 spins, and it turns out this is like a reincarnation of the famous spin charge separation in Schuh-Schieffer Hegel model. So for people that are familiar with it in 1D, 1 plus 1D dimensional models, one can make these defects, and by populating them either with 1 spin, these behave like spinons, or with 2 spins or 0, they behave like charge. And so one can separate the spin and charge degrees of freedom, and it really doesn't depend on time on particle hole symmetry. So lots of people might think that this really depends on particle hole symmetry, but you only require time reversal symmetry, because one can define some number operator and look at how the states behave under the number operator and under time reversal symmetry. And then a spinon is really defined in this manner, whereas a chargeon or a holon is defined in this manner. So I only need really time reversal symmetry to characterize the state. And indeed, this actually gives another way of defining the Z2 invariant in the bulk. So one can make this more explicitly, a bit more explicit. But the real point I want to make here is that the Z2 character of the topological insulator doesn't one can probe it by the edge states, by the existence of them, but also in the bulk by really looking if one binds this odd number of modes to a pi flux solenoid. Okay, so that's the main message I want to make here. And the reason why I'm saying that is because remember that we were thinking about defects and how to classify this extra of how to characterize and probe this extra layer of classification I was just talking about. And using the fact that these pi flux modes are really the probe in the bulk, we can now make this explicit in the following way. Because when we return to our dislocation, you see, as I said, for any loop that I draw around this defect, I always have to skip this extra row of atoms. But what this really gives is, like, if I think about in the bulk, that this really gives a phase shift, right? Because I always have to skip this extra row of atoms, so it's like a translation. So it gives me some phase k dot b, where b is the Burgess factor, and this is associated with the translation, the amount I have to jump. So for any loop that I draw around this defect, I always have to jump in the y direction here. So and that's called the Burgess factor. In this case, would just be one. I have to skip one extra row, so my Burgess factor would be y. So it would be in one unit in the y direction. But in the end, what's really important that this location gives me this phase shift, okay? So remember that this pi flux, if I have a pi flux solenoid, it really probes the topological insulator because it binds this odd number of modes. But now you see that this phase here can actually be pi and therefore act like a topological, like exactly like a pi flux. To be more specific, I can think about this two different states protected by time reversal symmetry I was just talking about on the square lattice. So remember that this one would be characterized by this minus 1, 1, 1, because or 1, minus 1, minus 1 in this case, and whereas this one has the odd one out at the pi pi point. So to be specific, here I have the odd one out at the gamma point. So if I would characterize it in the signs, let's say plus minus minus, whereas here I have plus plus and the minus at the pi pi point. So now going back to this phase shift, you see that this phase shift can actually be if I have some Burgess factor in the one direction or in the x direction or in the y direction, that here you would expect that the physics is really governed by this point by this gamma point, whereas here it's really governed by this pi pi point. So when I have an effective momentum of 0, this phase is always 0. Whereas when I'm at this effective momentum pi pi, this k dot b, where b is 1, will be pi, and exactly acting like a pi flux. And I know for a pi flux that I bind modes, and it is like really an alternative way of characterizing the Z2 invariant. So now you see, and one can do this numerically or actually analytically. But the outcome is as follows: that when I have this phase, so what I refer to as this gamma phase, which is dominated by this physics at the gamma point, If I insert a 5-flux, it really probes the Z2 invariant, so it's of course there, it binds these modes. But for the dislocation, again, because this effective momentum is zero, I don't bind any modes. So I can really, here I bind modes for a 5-flux, but I don't bind modes for dislocation. Whereas when I introduce a dislocation in this phase, it actually, the dislocation acts as a 5-flux, and it also binds modes for dislocation. So you see, by looking at the response of 5-fluxes and by dislocation, I can actually really probe these two different phases, which makes sense because, again, a dislocation is really the topological defect associated with translational symmetry breaking. I started from some A2, and I refined my classification scheme by the crystalline symmetry. So it's also not really weird that when I look at an object that probes these crystalline symmetries and is topological, is able to distinguish these two phases. Okay? So the real take-home message here again is that if I have some classification which I can also really probe by the response to dislocations and pi fluxes. More interestingly, if I think a bit more about this other phase, which was not protected by time reversal symmetry, but really by the fact that I had C4 symmetry, so I remember that I had an even number of minus sign, it turns out that when I have a pi flux, I actually get 4 modes, which makes sense because this thing is not protected by any time reversal symmetry, so I should be able to get the 2k with spares under generic interactions, which is true because I have 4 of them. Whereas when I have a dislocation, I actually get 2 modes. Again, this makes complete sense because when I think about this thing from a tenfold wave perspective, so only think about the time reversal invariant, that should be trivial. Whereas the extra layer of classification really comes from the underlying crystalline symmetries. And again, if I really probe it with the object of the crystalline symmetries, I get only 1 pair of modes. So this extra layer of classification really comes only into account when I add this extra layer of crystalline symmetries, and it's also really probed by this location in that sense. Okay. So to be a bit more specific, this can also be generalized to 3D. So I've been talking about 3D. But in 2D, one can actually think about this location. It now becomes a line, and again, it's in one-to-one correspondence with the extra layer of classification I just proposed. So we're looking at where this odd one out sign is located. Okay, that gives you some extra structure, and by specifying now my dislocation in 3 dimensions, so actually I can think about the stacking. And the only point I want to make is that this extra layer of classification can, just as in 2D, be really probed in 3D, right? So this can be generalized in the same sense. To be more specific, if you think about this example of a weak topological insulator, so really only translations and leaving all the rest behind, this classification actually exactly reduces to the same argument. And it was already found that this weak indices, so if I think about some stacking in some direction, so these are the Miller indices in some direction. So in particular, when I was thinking about the state in the Z direction, nu 3 would be 1 and the other ones would be 0, it was already figured out long ago that these translations could give you a phase pi or a phase shift pi, which resolved the modes. It was already observed by Ran, Zhang, and Vishnavat. But this whole argument can exactly be generalized in the same way as I just said in 3D, probing this extra layer of classification that I just argued about. Okay. Okay. So what we have so far is that I've been thinking about points in the Brillouin zone, how I can distribute the sign so roughly of how these points are connected. And on the other hand, I had some arguments about defect physics, that this extra layer of classification that I just introduced, so how signs are distributed, that there is like really a correspondence on the other side of how that they can be probed by the defects. Okay, so that's really the key message that I want to give, and that's one thing. And secondly, obviously, if I include crystalline symmetries, I get extra layers of classification. Okay, so that's the main message I want to make. Or a bit more generally, I said that if I have this distribution of signs, you can actually really distinguish four main classes. So first of all, remember that when this physics was really dominated by the odd one out at the gamma point, it didn't respond to dislocation, so it really acted like a continuum. Whereas when I have it at some, when I have an odd number of psi of odd ones out, but at the finite momentum, that I could probe it by this location. So that's what we call translationally active states. So they are protected by time reversal symmetry, but they can also be probed by dislocation, so they bound modes on the dislocations. Whereas I also had a third possibility in which I had an even number of signs, but then it was really protected only by the crystalline symmetry, so no TRS protection. And again, this could again this extra layer of classification could be probed by looking at the response of pi fluxes and, topo, and topological defects in the form of dislocations. And lastly, only in 3D I can have a weak TI. So, but remember, this only is allowed if my symmetry groups allows it, right? So if I had this stacking in the z direction, you see that this cannot happen when I have cubic symmetry because of this free-fold rotation I was just talking about, right? So sorry. So this weak TI is really only allowed when my symmetry group allows for effective slicing up, right? So really thinking about 2D layers. And in this limit, this extra layer of classification I just proposed really exactly reduces to this weak TI notion. Okay. So what I really have been presenting is some extra layer of classification that reduces to this weak invariance in 3D, but actually treats the 2D and 3D cases on a similar footing. It only reduces to this weak invariance in 3D just because there. Time reversal symmetry acts in a certain way that I can think about translations in some sense. Okay, so I have this distribution of signs in 2D and 3D actually gives you some extension of the weak invariance that treat both cases 2D and 3D and on a similar footing and reduces to the already previously found weak invariance in 3D. Okay, if I really forget about everything and only keep into account translations and time reversal symmetry, then it exactly reduces to the weak invariance in 3D and no weak invariance or extra invariance in 2D. Okay, so I've been presenting just an extra layer and a refinement of that. Okay, just as a very small side note, I want to say that this is not all hocus pocus because this defect could actually be interesting. Because recently it has this dislocation modes that I was just talking about have been observed or actually claimed to be observed experimentally. So it turns out that the very first topological insulator, the ORZ2 topological insulator that had been discovered, is this bismuth antimony compound, and it actually is of the translationally active type. So that actually is having this odd signs at the finite momentum. And in this sense, one predict dislocation modes. And what they did is like they imaged these dislocation modes and calculated the conductivity along the dislocation modes and perpendicular to it and saw some they claimed to see a difference in signal. So these dislocation modes could really really well be actually something for real and not just a way of classifying stuff theoretically, but as I said, this is a very first experiment, so lots of follow-ups have to be done, but at least the very first signatures are there, okay? So that's as a side note. Again, I presented an extra layer of classification which goes hand-in-hand with the defect physics, and it's really revolved about how points in the Brillouin zones or these odd signs are connected, right? So this is like the essential idea. So but now I return to my other question or my other promise is that I will explain how this K theory can actually be calculated, but not in class A2 because it, due to technical difficulties due to time reversal symmetry, your K theory becomes so-called twisted. But this whole idea of how points are connected, actually, I now want to show that it really makes sense in terms of a mathematical picture that it allows us to calculate this K theory, but then in class A, just due to technical difficulties, okay? So now we're going to switch from class A, from A2 to class A, and I'm going to show you that this idea of how points are connected. It's really giving me a way of how to calculate this K theory in class A, and not only the K theory itself, but actually all classes in class A, so class A including space group symmetries. Okay, so that will be the last part of the talk. And to make this a bit more formal, if you remember the very first slide, I actually had some K here, and then I said this K theory is some group that gives you, it's a mathematical machinery and outputs a number. But for people that have been alert, you can see that now this K actually has an extra label here, okay? And this extra label here is exactly the space group I want to consider. So I'm looking at K theory that incorporates the space group, and that's so-called twisted equivariant K theory. So this equivariant comes from the fact that I'm including this space group. So I want to calculate this K theory for class A, including all space group things. And what I claim, or what I will present, is that I can calculate this by exactly this idea of how points are connected in class A, okay? So this is what we're going to do now. And the way I'm going to present this of how to calculate this guy is by a specific example. So I'll walk you through a specific example, and then we'll completely, I hope, completely elucidate this idea that of how things connect really allows me to calculate this K theory. So let's do that. And in particular, I want to again focus on my favorite lattice, so a square lattice. Okay, so we're focusing on my square lattice, in space group notation, this is P4MM. So what it means is that this P4 shows that it's primitive. So I just have I imagine to have my atom sitting on the side, and this P4 shows me that I have fourfold rotations around the primitive side, right? So I have my primitive side, and obviously I have fourfold rotations. Then the first M, and then I have two M's, which actually refer to the fact that I have two mirrors. So I have a mirror in the X direction and a mirror in the Y direction. Obviously, when I'm mirroring this line or this line, the system is invariant, right? So that's why this my favorite square lattice actually has space group P4MM, okay? So now I will present this, how to calculate this K theory in a very algorithmic setup. So the first step in our algorithm actually pertains to determining the so-called fundamental domain. So if I think about topology, the first step I have to do is go from real space to K space, okay? Because topology is really defined on my vector bundle in K space. So I go from real space to K space. And remember that I have a square lattice with P4MM, then my Brillouin is also a square again. So for me, this is minus pi pi, and this is minus pi, I said. And here, this is pi pi, okay? And this is my gamma point. But now you see that if I do fourfold rotations, that I actually only need this triangle, okay? Because if I have this triangle, I can completely tile the full Brillouin zone if I active my symmetry. So if I do a mirror symmetry, or fourfold rotations or combinations of them, you can see that I can cover the whole Brillouin zone. Okay, that's clear, I guess. So my first step is just to determine the smallest unit that doesn't get repeated under symmetry, and that's what my fundamental domain, loosely speaking. But in this case, is that is this triangle. Okay. As a second step, I just want to define special points. So remember that in my class A2 evaluation, I was looking at special points, which were actually the time reverse invariant points. Remember that where we looked at this anti-symmetric object and looked at the plus and minus signs. Here I have to define analogously special points. Remember that we're now in class A, so I have to define my special points, and my special points are purely set by my crystalline symmetry, because in class A I only have my class A and my crystalline symmetry. And my special points I define as follows. So in this P4MM, I have the following operations. As I said, I have fourfold rotations, which is implemented by this operator R. So R sends a value in the Brillouin zone kx ky to minus ky kx. So this is a fourfold rotation. Then I have a mirror. Mirror about the x-axis. Or which sends ky to minus ky, and all the other elements of the group. So if I have a fourfold rotation, this is a pi over two rotation, I can make my pi rotation of 3 pi over 2 rotation by just squaring r or putting r to the r cube. Or when I want to, I here I have my mirror which sends ky to minus ky, so the mirror about the x-axis. But obviously, when I do r squared times t, that basically sends kx to minus kx, so that will be the mirror about y, about ky. Okay. So I really need only these two elements, and so this generates all my symmetries in my Brillouin and so on. And remember that now I want to define special points, and special points I define as follows. Special points are my Brillouin zone, are points that are left invariant by more than the identity. And in other words, my special points in my Brillouin zone are points that have a non-trivial little cogroup. So obviously, any point that I take in my Brillouin zone, so let's take this point, it's left invariant by the identity. Yes? If I just have kx, ky, and I apply identity, it stays invariant. But are points that are left invariant by more. In particular, look at this gamma point. If I look at this gamma point, if I have my kx and ky here, and I do a four-fold rotation on them, obviously it gets mapped to itself. Gamma just gets mapped to itself on their four-fold rotation. Okay? Similarly, what I had is these two mirrors in the x and the y direction. So when I do a mirror in the x direction or in the y direction here, also gamma gets mapped to itself. Okay? So gamma is left invariant by four-fold rotations and by both of the mirrors. In other words, gamma is left invariant by the full point group, D4. Okay? When I go to the endpoint, you see that it's also left invariant by more than just the identity. To be specific, when I do four-fold rotations around the endpoint, it's also mapped to itself. When I do a mirror in the about the ky axis, m goes to minus m, but it's the same point modulo a lattice translation, modulo a lattice vector, okay? Similarly, also when I do it about the x direction, m gets to minus m here, so that's also the same point modulo a lattice translation. In other words, also m is left invariant by fourfold rotations and by both mirrors. Again, the group that leaves m invariant is the full point group, which is d4, okay? So gamma and m actually are special points because they don't have the identity leaving them invariant, but the full point group, d4. Now this point x is also left invariant by more than the identity. So when I do a mirror about the kx axis, obviously x gets mapped to itself. When I do a mirror about the y direction, it also gets mapped to itself modulo lattice translation, okay? X is not left invariant by fourfold rotations. Because when I have this point x, it gets mapped to a point y, which is a different point. It's an inequivalent point. Yes? So in other words, the group that leaves x invariant is simply z2 times z2, just the two mirrors. Okay? Obviously, if I think about mirrors, it has two it's something that squares to one, so it can have eigenvalues 1 or minus 1. But this point is left invariant by z2 times z2. That's the little cogroup here. Okay? So these are my three special points, gamma, x, and m, okay? So that was the second point of our algorithm. We have defined points that are special. And the special points in this case, very much like the time reversing invariant points in the A2 class, are now actually set by the crystalline symmetry in our class A. And these are points that have a non-trivial little cogroup, okay? So now what I can do is I can start counting, and this counting will basically calculate the K-theory. So this counting works as follows. So when remember that I have my special points, and my special points are left invariant by more than the identity by some group. And in case of gamma it was d4, in case of m it was also d4, in case of x it was z2 times z2. Okay? Well, what I can do is, if I have some band structure, if any band will have to transform in an irreducible representation of this symmetry group, okay? So any band that at gamma will have to transform under some irreducible representation of d4. What I can do, I can start counting how many bands transform under a specific representation at this gamma point. So if I look up d4, I can just look up how many irreducible representations this guy has, and it turns out to have 5 irreducible representations. So what I can do now is I can define 5 integers, which just count how many bands transform under a specific irreducible representation at that point. So here, N1 gamma really counts how many bands are transforming under in irreducible representation 1, at the gamma point. So this is just a Z number. Okay, I have 5 Z numbers. this number n gamma 3 just counts how many bands transform under irreducible representation 3 at the gamma point. Yes? Similarly, the endpoint was left invariant by D4, so I can define 5 of such integers again, right? So just to be really clear, N5M just counts the number of bands transforming an irreducible representation number 5 at the endpoint. Yes? So I have five integers. Obviously, when I have at X, I have 4 integers. Okay, because I have 4 irreducible representations, because if I have mirrors are like even and odd, so I can have even, odd, even, odd, or odd, even, right? So 4 irreducible representations. Again, I can define 4 invariants. Sorry, this is a typo. This should be X, of course. So I can define 4 integers where this N1X really defines how many bands are transforming an irreducible representation 1 at the X point, okay? So I just have defined 14 integers. 14 integers. Okay? Now, if I have these 14 integers, they are not all in the independent. So in particular, when I have a band that's you see this L1 or this L2 point or this L3 points are actually also left invariant by the mirror. So think about this L1 line. This guy is left invariant by the mirror. This whole line is left invariant by the mirror. Obviously, when ky goes to minus ky, if I walk along this one, it's left invariant by this mirror about this axis, right? So that means that if a band is odd here at gamma, it should also be odd here at x. Okay? So this gives me a relation that if I remember that if I can look up which of these irreducible representations are even or which ones are odd under the mirror. So in particular, if I look them up, it turns out that this N1, this 0 and this 2 were actually even, and 4, because it's a doublet, these were even at gamma. These are even bands that are even under this mirror. If they transform under this irreducible representation, they have to be even. Similarly, I can look up which irreducible representation at X are even. And so if I have an even band here, it's going to go from one representation to another, but I know that because this whole line is left invariant by the mirror, that if it's odd here or even here, it should be even here, okay? So that relates that the number of even bands should be equal to the number of even bands at gamma, should be equal to the number of even bands at X. So that relates the number of bands in this irreducible representations to this ones, okay? Similarly, if band is odd here, it should be odd here, so I can look up which of the representations are odd, and also for gamma and x, and that gives me the same kind of relation, okay? This relation I did for L1, but I can also do for L2, because it's left invariant by this mirror, or L3, which is left invariant by the combination of these two mirrors, like in the x and y direction. So what I can do is I can just make this long list of constraints. I just look at how these points are connected. Again, how are these points are connected, and it gives me relations on these integers I define. So I write down all the relations I can find, and they don't all have to be independent, of course. In particular, if I sum all the irreducible representation here, it should be equal to the sum here to the sum here, because the number of bands cannot change, of course. So I write down all this constraint, and then I just take the rank. And this rank turns out to be 5 in this case, okay? So I started from 14 integers. I have five constraints. And then there's one other Z number that I have to specify specifically, and that's the Chern number, because the Chern number can happen within one band. But obviously, this can be determined very simple, because if I have a mirror symmetry, then the Chern number always has to be 0. So when I have, in this case, I have a mirror symmetry, so the Chern number has to be 0, so I don't have to add anything. And what I get is exactly z to the 9th, right? I started from 40 integers, 5 constraints, so it gives me z to the 9th.
Robert, can you close to wrap up? Because we're almost out of time.
Yes. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? 4 minutes?
Yeah, so we've been talking an hour now, so if you can wrap it up in 5 minutes, would be great.
Oh, sure. Sorry. Yes, sure. So this gives me exactly this KVU computation, okay? One other thing, and this doesn't only work for so-called symorphic space groups, but also for non-symorphic space groups. So in this case, the representation are actually projective representation, but I can do the exact same algorithm. So this allows me to map out all the classes by just counting. I just define integers and relations and just count them. And it completely reproduces the KT. It doesn't only work in 2D, but also in 3D. So in particular, I can do this really nasty group like OH, and it turns out that I have actually 22 invariants. Okay, 22 invariants, but just counting. So this counting algorithm just gives me a way to calculate this K theory. So I just wanted to say that with this invariant, one can also, because you know all the topological phases, you also know the boundaries in between. So I can also map out all the wild phases, and they are exactly in agreement with this invariant, because the bands have to switch somewhere. Okay, I will skip that due to time, sorry. But we really can map out all these phases from a K-theory perspective in class A by just the way how points are connected and counting, just counting Z numbers, okay? And somewhat recently, this has been picked up by this Princeton and Harvard group, which actually use our ways to map out the whole band structure and then define something which is trivial. So with trivial, they mean that the subset of band structures in this complete space that are trivial are the ones that have a one-year representation that are called, so that can be continued to the atomic limit. So when I divide out this whole space by the atomic limit, it also gives some handle of going beyond class A. Okay, so this has been a proposal using these gluing conditions I just gave you. One can map out this whole space, but can determine subclasses if I add extra symmetry, like in class A2, time inverse symmetry. Define what you call as trivial and divide out, and it gives you some handle about maybe attacking other classes. But here the map to K-theory is not explicit, okay? I just want to say that this has been follow-up by some very good groups, and this could be some food for the future. So with here I would like to wrap up. So what I've been really talking about is that this class A2 ideas of how things can connect is directly related to defect physics. This defect physics actually has been measured, or be claimed to be measured lately. But this idea can then be used in class A to really do this K-theory evaluation for a very simple algorithm. So I gave you a very simple algorithm of how these points connect and calculating these invariants, and this allows me to completely enumerate this K-theory, which is actually a very profound mathematical framework. If you want to do it from the mathematical side, this is, of course, quite challenging. But we can really map this and do this for any symmetry group. And this mapping is really exact for class A. And now we're trying to, one of the things is, of course, to attack other symmetry classes, which is this proposal by the Bernevik and Vishnawat group I was just talking about. Obviously, there's much food for thought. And actually, I already have some new examples of magnetic space groups, but I will leave that for another time. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, I have one quick question. Because if you usually have, without the space groups, just the A class, it corresponds to integer quantum Hall effect, right? Where the where there's also a physical interpretation of the integer, right? The x y conductivity. So yeah, if you have it on a square lattice, it's z to the 9. Are there really like 9 different physical quantities there, or those are more like abstract?
Yeah. So this is really an exact K theory calculation. So this is exhaustive. These are all the invariants that exist, but the specific physical meaning I'm not sure about yet. So I have already something in preparation about Wilson loops of how I can constrain some of them. So, but this is still a theoretical tool. So, of course, this makes them insightful. I can loop some of them, and actually, this is consistent with this gluing condition. So that's rather nice. And this is something that will appear shortly. But of course, another thing is that one can go to the boundary. But because these guys are really protected by space group symmetries, going to a boundary is a bit more tricky. I don't have some time reversal symmetry that's respected at the boundary. If I go to a boundary, I break symmetry. So then you would think that if you break some symmetries, you can get some edge states for some of the symmetries that break. But this would be a bit more complicated because from a more fundamental perspective, one could think that there's some orbi folding on the boundary. So I start from some symmetry group and start orbi folding this guy. And maybe can give me some handle on the edge states. But to be honest, I'm sure that there are just 9 of these invariants. So this is because this is a mathematical exact calculation. I have some work in progress of how to constrain them with Wilson loops and how to make them more insightful, but the physical interpretation is still lacking, and that's something. But it's quite interesting that there's so many more invariants that we don't understand. So that's definitely room for the future to make them physically more explicit.
Okay, well, thank you for the talk, and thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Okay.